So, Charlie, what do we need to talk about? What's the most important thing?
Well, I don't think much is happening. So
yeah, there's not much going on.
Yeah, you know, it's a slow news cycle, yeah, as they might say. Look, it's a very interesting time. I've actually done a lot of traveling in the last few weeks, which is a very... You must really hate yourself if you do that. You have to wear the mask the entire time, and it's, you know, not exactly fun. But I've been to Michigan, Florida. I was in New York, all across the country. I was in D.C. yesterday, in Arizona this morning, and here I am with you. I feel that it's more urgent than ever to be able to get truth out in front of people. Yeah. And I think that right now, we as a country are seeing what happens when good people decide to do nothing. And when certain good people such as yourself, Jack, and your congregation start to stand up for truth. So look, I'm processing this in real time like all of you, and I'm starting to realize a couple things. The first of which is this. What's happening tonight in the churches across America, this is going to be the salvation of our country. It really will.
That's right.
The church is the key to the moral order of a civil society. And there's a reason why they want to keep the churches closed. There's a reason why they don't want you to be able to congregate. It's because as soon as all of you start to attend and you listen to the greatest, most important book ever to exist in the history of the world, when you start to understand the teachings of Jesus Christ, when you start to understand that our rights are natural, that come from God, not from government, all of a sudden Gavin Newsom means a lot less in your world. All of a sudden... And maybe it also opens and liberates conversation. Maybe all of a sudden you realize that it's going to be free people in a free society that are going to come across to the best solutions, not these bureaucratic, top-down orders that have just so much harm and pain and suffering on people across the country that I've seen, Jack. And I'll tell you this, that as the churches start to reopen, I'm starting to see it, pastors are starting to follow because it takes leaders like Jack to pay the price, and he goes for it, and then people start to follow. And we're starting to see, in my opinion, a tonal shift in our country in the last couple weeks. Even the last couple days, I can feel it. All of a sudden, people are, and I felt the Holy Spirit here tonight, I think you do as well.
Yeah,
we're all of a sudden, look, the forces of darkness are going to strike their hardest right before truth is really going to spread and win. That is when the forces of darkness are going to do their full frontal offensive. And boy, have we seen that in the last couple weeks, in the last couple months. And what I'm telling you, I am bringing you, I believe, very good news that we are close to something that is so righteous and good and true. I think we're going to have a revival in our country, the likes of which we have never seen.
Right. Yeah.
I truly believe that.
I do believe that. Yeah. Charlie, you said something on one of your recent podcasts, I think it was with Eric Metaxas. Yeah. You made mention of the fact that, which was fantastic, that the rioting, the pillaging, the protesting that's going on in the streets, in the correlation between that and the churches being sequestered.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really puzzling thing for me why some people are confused about this. They say, why is it that so many people are angry and looking for meaning? I say, well, it's because you closed the churches down, man. I mean, church is more than just flipping on your TV at 10:30 in your pajamas in the living room. Church is the ecclesia, the gathering of believers. It's you turning to your friend and saying, how you doing? And they say, honestly, I'm not doing well.
Right.
I need you, and I needed that message today. And what we have been led to believe is now church is nothing more than a digital consumption exercise, where church is a 24/7, 365 institution, where it's brothers helping believers, helping sisters, helping people in need.
Right.
And so then we remove that, and I asked Jack this today, and I said, on average, how many people come to Christ on Easter Sunday? And he says, anywhere probably between 100 to 150, maybe even more. On an Easter Sunday, the most important day that we celebrate as Christians, for good reason. They stole that from us, and we let them. They stole Easter Sunday from us. So I think to myself, my goodness, how many millions of lost souls out there would have become Bible-believing Christians on Easter Sunday if the churches would have remained open? How many people would have dropped down their idolatry of fake witness and said, Jesus, come into my life?
Yeah.
And yet the secular humanist status said, keep your church closed because I told you so. And then all of a sudden we wonder why in late May We see a destruction of civil society because, oh my gosh, we forgot that it was the church that built civil society.
That's right.
And when civil society starts to crumble and you don't have the singular thing that founded that very civil society, it should be a rather logical thing. Maybe you should open the institution that gives people meaning and gives them an understanding of what responsibility is and a connection to the Almighty and the sacraments of communion. And so there's a direct connection there. And I think there's a reason for it. It's because the statists understand, and the people that want to control you, because that's what this is about. This is about power. They want government to become God. They want white fragility to become the Bible. They want the 1619 Project to be more well-versed in the teachings of Matthew. And if you think I'm joking, just step into a public school in LA Unified School District, and you'll see exactly what I mean. They know that if they can hurt the church, if they can weaken the church, then all of a sudden they will replace man's search for meaning with government becoming that deity, with Nicole Hannah Jones from the New York Times becoming the next philosophical leader where she just spouts garbage and nonsense professionally every single day. And so we have to understand very clearly, and you've done such a great job of this, Jack, and I'm inspired by you, and you're a hero for this, which is, we are not going to allow tyranny in our country to exist any longer, whether it be Gavin Newsom, whether it be the little micro-tyranny. And here's a really important point, is that we should protest and recall Gavin Newsom. And he's a coward. He's like, what is he going to do? I mean, come on. I mean, he really is a very weak person. And no, I mean this. And I truly do genuinely pray for him. And where he prioritizes Planned Parenthood abortion clinics and marijuana dispensaries over the body and blood of Jesus Christ.
Yes.
And he argues the church is not essential. And I think that's actually a wrong phrasing, by the way. I think a better way to phrase it and ask, is salvation essential? It's not just essential. It's like the only important thing, right? I mean, it's the idea of essential is somehow there's a hierarchy of something more important than salvation. And so, look, Gavin Newsom, he says, well, I might arrest people. I say, well, you won't be the first Christian to pay a price for what is good and what is right and what is true. And so if they come arrest Jack, come arrest me alongside of Jack, because I'll tell you what, it's about time Christians start standing for something in this country. And here's the one thing is, make no mistake, this is a social conditioning exercise where they're trying to see how far they can push us, right?
Right.
They're trying to see, oh, wow, the Christians won't speak if we take Easter and Palm Sunday from them. They won't speak out if we take Pentecost from them. They won't speak out if month after month after month, all of a sudden, the physical institution of the church and the gathering, the ecclesia of believers mean nothing. But the moment that someone like Jack Hibbs or Rob McCoy says, oh, no, come arrest us, they're like, oh, yeah, just kidding, sorry. And by the way, they might storm through this right now like Mao's Red Guard with their little red book and the Praetorian Guard. And guess what? Jack and I will say, fine. The part of the doctrine of civil disobedience is we will pay the price, but you are going to have a couple thousand very angry local people that are not going to like that.
They're voters.
And they vote, and they pay taxes. And the silent majority won't be silent much longer. And they are betting that our decency translates into apathy. And I can tell you this. There is a lot of green space between us being decent and us being indecent. And I'm telling you, I will never think we should get to indecent, but that doesn't mean we have to be quiet. It's a very important thing. It's an incredibly important distinction. Because, and I truly believe this, some Christian pastors have been emailing me privately and say, Charlie, what do I do? And I say, in some ways, why don't you surrender anything that is earthly for the divine truth to be able to bring people to Jesus Christ? And they say, I might lose my church. And I say, well, first of all, you probably won't, probably. But even if you do, if you fight for what is right, for what is good, and for what is true, isn't that what we are called to do every single day?
Every day.
And what the great irony of this entire thing, and it kind of reminds me of some of the people in the Republican Party where I've tried to find to see if they have a spine, and I can't quite figure out if they do or not, which is the great irony, and I'll do the connection in a second, is that this church has never flourished like it has now, and it has never grown because people right now in times of chaos are looking for order. They're looking for truth. Churches that actually stand have record attendance, record tithing, record conversions, record salvation, record amounts of people that are looking for that meaning. And so I'll tell you what, as Ernest Hemingway said, this is going to happen gradually, then suddenly. Mm-hmm. The bad guys are going to be on the run very quickly as soon as reasonable and decent people stop being the silent majority and the vocal majority. It's going to happen very, very quickly.
Charlie, we've got a radical civil unrest in many of the West Coast cities, the key cities. Just the other day, Jerry Nadler, when asked about the pillaging and the rioting of Portland, Oregon, Nadler said that Antifa and that action is a myth. Yeah, it's not happening.
You know, it's so incredibly Orwellian what's happening right now. And if you haven't read 1984 or Animal Farm, I encourage you to do it. It's like reading the LA Times. It's happening in real time. And let me explain to you how Orwellian thinking works. It's written by George Orwell in the 1950s. Orwell was a socialist until he wasn't, because he actually realized what that nonsense, backwards worldview actually believed. His most famous quote with socialism, I just love it, it's so perfect. Orwell said, "Socialism is much more about hating the rich than helping the poor." I said, "That is just perfect." And so Orwell wrote 1984, and in it he talks about that even worse than a lie, there's something that can be called doublethink or doublespeak or newspeak. So here's how it works, and this is what's happening with Jerry Nadler and the left, where it's much worse than them lying to us. So let's pretend Jack is eating some cookies here, and I go up to Jack, I say, "Jack, how many cookies have you eaten?" And he says, "I've only eaten 3. He really ate 10. That would be a lie, right? Here's how doublespeak works. I go up to Jack and I say, "Jack, how many cookies have you eaten?" And he's got crumbs all over his face and cookies. And he says, I haven't eaten any cookies. You have. No, trust me, I've eaten no cookies. I promise, no cookies. No, you've eaten all the cookies. In fact, you're also a racist. Like, what? No, I'm not. Like, no, I promise. He's like, "Shut up and take a knee. I've never eaten cookies. You're also a bad person and your country is awful." Like, "No, I promise, I haven't eaten cookies."
They
and you start to think to yourself, what kind of bizarre thing? And that's doublespeak, and it's 1984 dystopianism, and he prophesied it perfectly. And look, it's really, in 1 Timothy, what's the exact verse? To live quiet and peaceable lives,
yeah,
right?
God tells us that he wants us to pray for the king and those that are over us in authority, that we, why, what's the reason? That we might live a quiet and peaceable life.
So not Portland. Basically.
Not Portland, not Seattle, not LA.
I was reading that the other day. I said, my goodness, he was telling us to live lives like whatever's not happening in downtown Seattle and the former country that used to be called Chaz or Chop or whatever that wonderful experiment was, which really interests me because, you know, I visit college campuses so you don't have to. And and I deal with these people, right? And it's a very sinister combination between remarkable arrogance and resentment and totally uninformed opinion, right? So they're so committed to being correct, they're constantly wrong, but they're never in doubt. It's an incredible combination, right?
That's well said.
So I'll never forget one of these rocket scientist philosophers came up to me. He was 20 and he had taken a philosophy course, so he knew everything about philosophy. And University of Minnesota, and I think I saw him on television the other day burning down a building or something. I was like, that's the guy. I knew he was destined for great things. And so it was a couple years ago at University of Minnesota, and he said, "Charlie, you don't understand. Once we get rid of police and private property, that's when human beings can go back to their normative state, the primitive state, and everything will go back into a utopian place." And this is an idea that was theorized by the French fool. If you want to know where most bad ideas from, just go to France. I mean, my gosh, just Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I mean, the guy was a hypocritical, privileged brat who basically, we got a lot of our bad ideas in the West from him. But he argued very, very bluntly that we should have the primitive over the civilized, the infant over the adult, the passionate lover over the calm spouse. I mean, basically everything your child learns in college can be originated back to this clueless, you know, let's stop there, a guy from France by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So this idea of we just get rid of, it's society that's the problem, it's not us. No, you're actually awesome. You are perfect. You don't have original sin. It's societal sin. That's what you have to understand that the difference is right now, right? So this philosopher from University of Minnesota who just took a freshman introductory class of how to hate America, right? And so he was telling me, Charlie, you don't understand. It's this great thing. And I'll never forget this conversation because I said, one day you're going to get what you want and it's not going to end well. And I said, one day you guys are going to get so bold and you might actually form your own little communal country. And write me a memo on how that goes. And he said, I can't wait. It'll be brilliant. The revolution is coming. And this is a couple years ago, and they actually ended up acting on these foolish ideas. And so they founded CHAZ or CHOP or whatever, which in a very interesting way, I was perplexed by this. And we, at Turning Point USA, we sent journalists into CHAZ and we infiltrated it. And they had borders. It was really bizarre. Yes. It was like,
Guarded. That was the first thing.
And they had ID checks. I'm like, well, now we can have voter ID everywhere now, right? Because in order to get into CHAZ, you had to check your identification. And so you go in there and they have no police and all this. And incredibly bad things continued to happen. And tragically, two people died. And one African-American black kid died who was a teenager, murdered. And it's this amazing thing, Jack. When you get rid of police, people still do bad things. It's almost as if original sin actually exists in our world and that the Bible is completely correct, that we're broken, so unbelievably depraved by nature that we are in need of a Savior that only a loving God could deliver to us, that it's actually what is in our book is true and right. And so, but this is what's really what we're up against. And I want to just frame this for you because you say, who could possibly defund the police? Who could want that? They come from a worldview.
That's right.
That we are actually awesome human beings. That we, by nature, are good. This is what we're up against. Right, what's happening right now, and this is what really frustrates me with a lot of the Republican Party, is just how myopic they get in their conversation. They're like, well, maybe we can pass a police reform bill. And maybe you can, maybe you can't. But you're missing the broader point. We have just introduced a national conversation on human nature, and you think this is about police reform?
Exactly.
This is a beautiful opportunity to be able to defend something that through 5,000 years of history and this incredible book that tells us that is ultimate truth, that human beings are broken by nature. And we know this, and the left doesn't believe this. They actually are so incredibly confident in their own hubris, in their own philosopher king world. I can fix human beings. All we have to do is get rid of the police and then give a little health care and no borders and all. Of course, it's a bunch of rubbish and nonsense and balderdash. But what's, I got all sorts of words that are non-swear words to say, to describe the left, by the way.
Brilliant.
Being a podcaster that has PG-rated audience, the amount of words I can use to describe the American left is limitless. So that's a fun sidebar. So, Jerry, I guess the point was about Jerry Nadler, and that's to kind of complete the point, was this, they truly believe, the radical left absolutely and completely believes that society is a mistake, that the systems we have around us are systems of oppression that must be dismantled, undone, and deconstructed because they have the better idea to be implemented, and then we can actually be harmonious people in utopia, which literally means nowhere, if you look at actually what utopia means. That's what they believe. So right now we're in a discussion on human nature. We should win that conversation. We should win that argument, I should say.
Do you think there's any I think you just answered this, actually, but just to highlight it, do you think there's any correlation to the fact that two of the least churched cities in America happen to be Portland and Seattle?
Of course.
There's almost no presence of church witness.
And it would be nice to hear a Republican say that once, wouldn't it? I mean, but look, I say this is, we have an amazing opportunity to be able to defend right now something that is true. And Paul says it, defend whatsoever is true. I mean, we are called to Christians to call out things that are not correct, not factual, not true in every single part of our life, because everything that you encounter matters. We're told that as Christians. Anytime that something that gets told that is rooted in a lie, that is a tool used by the evil one to try to deceive us and bring us into confusion and chaos. So when people say something like, everything's actually wonderful in Portland, you don't understand. 56 days of riot and anarchy, this is actually, it's a summer of love, actually, is what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a summer of love until they start protesting outside of the mayor's office, right, which is what they do. And so, yes, there's a direct correlation, and We have to understand that this country that was founded, it wasn't an accident. And that's a really important thing that we have to teach our kids. Unlike other kind of civilization toppling and just the constant cycle, if you will. We are going to control this piece of land and we're going to put it over with our tradition. Our country is so different than that. We don't teach our young people. This was a deliberative process of reading, reflecting, praying, and fasting of what do we want to create? And this was founded. This wasn't something that we backed into like, oh my gosh, what if we just like have this free speech thing? I came up with it and everyone can say whatever they want. Everyone's going to own guns and like Ben Franklin, like this country's going to be lit, right? Like this is going to be great. Right? No, there's a reason for all of this, right? This wasn't some sort of juvenile experiment in trying to have people indulge themselves. This was a study of Mesopotamia and Athens and Greece and Rome and Aristotle and Plato and Aquinas and Descartes and Hume and Locke. And you said, okay, here's what they got wrong. Here's what they got right. And the Enlightenment understood this. And Locke theorized very simply that, yes, we have natural law. And from natural law, we have natural rights. And then they said, well, what if it's a theocracy? They said, that won't work because then you're a state-run religion. It actually make people less likely to go to church. So let's have ideas that are actually built upon that of Christianity, the Bible, the greatest book ever to exist in the history of the world. We like that. And everyone in our population is basically understands it's the moral order, but we want to have a pluralistic society and
that's right.
The freedom of speech because good ideas must be defended, not be just shoved down people's throats because if we just say this is what it is, people are going to find a way to disconnect from it because that's human nature. They want to challenge and question. We know that from the Enlightenment. We know that from basically the problems that the Catholic Church had with trying to have state-run religion. The founders didn't want that, but they still wanted the moral order. And that's why in our birth certificate, the Declaration of Independence says the laws of nature and nature's God very explicitly, where it said, you know what, King George, this whole tyranny and autocracy thing, not so fast, my friend. We have a better idea from ideas that are derived from the law of Abraham and Moses and the tradition of the Bible that was fulfilled by the covenant of Jesus Christ. We're going to try out freedom of speech, protect our family, rights to privacy, states' rights, and guess what? If we get something wrong, we can course correct it because we don't have to worry about your tyranny, one-size-fits-all centralized control. We have a republic if we can keep it. Let's see what happens. This was the biggest risk in human history.
That's right.
I want you to understand there was no precedent to this. They had very little to no civilization precedent. They took this risk and they said, we actually trust our people who were freedom-seeking pilgrims, who brought everything across the Atlantic Ocean. Many of them died. Even more of them paid a huge price in more ways than one. Go forth, try out this liberty thing. And oh my goodness, it spread like wildfire. Every country that has civil society, they should say, thanks, America. We owe you. We started it. We rebelled against tyranny for a reason, for a moral good and a moral government. And we should be proud of that every single day. And for the societal deconstructionists and the arsonists that try to say this bitter lie, they say, well, America was founded on slavery. And if I may, Jack, go into this.
You're quoting now, who is that?
Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Yes.
She has a very perplexing aesthetic.
I just want to make sure we give credit.
She has red hair. I just don't quite... Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
No.
I want to give credit where credit is due. When complete rubbish gets spewed from the paper of record, I want to make sure I get it right, unlike them, because they don't get it right. So Nicole Hannah-Jones, she is on a pathological campaign to make sure your kids hate America. And so Nicole Hannah-Jones, red hair, see her on TV, always talking about how awful white people are and how awful our country is. She's a bitter racist. I actually call her racist because I think racism is hatred of anyone of any skin color at any time. I think it is sinful and hateful and awful, and it is a sin. That's simple. Okay.
Yeah.
So she says that our country was founded in 1619, the first year that slaves came to our country. This is not correct. It's not. So if you actually look at the founding of our country, 1776, this great leap forward, 2,000 years forward, derived, of course, from the teachings of Athens and the combination of Jerusalem, Aristotle, Plato, Descartes, Aquinas, Locke, all the best practices put into one, authored by who? Thomas Jefferson, very important. I'll get back to him in a second, who says, laws of nature and nature's God. What happens in 1777? First state ever to abolish slavery. Vermont says, that's it, we're done. Why? We're inspired by this document. They abolished slavery. We were inspired on the abolition of slavery. When they were putting together the Constitution, it was never a conversation, ever. Don't let the people, the New York Times and Nicole Hannah-Jones tell you any different.
That's
it was never a question of whether or not we would have slavery. It was how we were going to get rid of this sinful practice. It was around for thousands of years. It was around before Christ. It was around after Christ. It is a sin. So our country was founded. Constitutional Convention, 1787. In 1787, George Washington says no new slaves at all, no slavery in the Northwest Territory. So anything forward, no slavery at all. They won't teach your kids that. Then,
that's
moving
right.
forward, in the Constitution, you can read it yourself, 20-year moratorium on the slave trade. You got 20 years, Southern states, then it is coming to an end. Reappears Thomas Jefferson, who actually introduced a bill in the early 1790s in the Virginia House of Commons, who said that slavery was an awful practice, I want to get rid of it. Now, mind you, it was probably one of the most perplexing pieces of hypocrisy in history because he himself was a slave owner, but he still was arguing for a moral good societally, failed in the Virginia House eventually. Eventually, of course, it succeeded. We saw in the 1790s, almost every single northern state abolished slavery. By the time 1807 happened, Thomas Jefferson had his time to shine. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States of our country, that 20 years, tick, 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 in the Constitution, right? They did that as a bargain with the Southern states. Thomas Jefferson, on the first day he was legally able to abolish the incoming of any new slaves into the United States of America 20 years into our founding. That is something we should be proud of. We were founded from the moment that we started that said that this was wrong and this is evil. Now, mind you, it wasn't a perfect history. It went through decades of ups and downs, and we went through a bloody civil war. But show me another country that sacrificed so much, brother against brother and father against son, to accomplish something that what? The churches were screaming in the pews and the pulpits, and Thaddeus Stevens was inspired by a pastor to go to Congress and say, slavery is anti-American. Our founders said it. Thaddeus Stevens said it. We fought this bitter civil war, and Abraham Lincoln kept the republic together on this unionist idea that I think America's best day can be ahead of us, where all men are equal and free. Fast forward all the way to Frederick Douglass, where he says that we need to abolish slavery. Why? Because I'm so inspired by the Declaration of Independence. He was an abolitionist, a black Republican who understood it. Go all the way fast forward to the great Martin Luther King Jr., who himself lived a very, let's say, he had questionable moral decisions, but he was arguing for what? A moral good. Why do I keep on saying this? Because people can act sinfully personally, but argue for something righteously publicly, and they should be remembered for what they did good publicly, not for what they did less than desirably privately. It's a very important thing. People say, well, we got to get rid of all these people, but dare you forget what they sacrificed for our country. And Martin Luther King said in that beautiful speech, I come here to cash in the check of the promissory note of the Declaration of Independence. Yes. He didn't say that this document was racist. He didn't say we got to shred it from its roots. He says, this document says all men are created equal. And I'm telling you, Congress, to pass the Civil Rights Act. From that moment that we started this country to the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, it was a constant theme, a march and a progression to be better. And isn't that what we do every single day in our own life, to try to be better today than we were yesterday? We cannot forget our history. We should be proud of it. No other country has pursued a moral good like the United States of America. Be proud of this country.
Yep. Charlie, are we not, though, now reaping 50, 60 years of university
indoctrination.
Indoctrination, and I was going to say a detox from truth regarding the teaching of wrong history, of absolute craziness, where now these kids are adults, and now they're in Congress, or now they're running, they're whatever they are, and they hate this nation. They don't even know it. They don't a bit of what you just said. No. Have we not made these kids in our universities and our public school system?
Absolutely. And look, this is going to be a very difficult thing for us to societally unpack as a culture in the next couple of years. But we have to admit that we were much more afraid of us losing societal status than our kids possibly being trained to not believe in God and hate America. And we sent our kids to these universities for decades, and then they all of a sudden become bitter, resentful activists in the streets, and we said, where did I go wrong? Mm-hmm. Well, you sent the indoctrination camp might have played a very big role in that. And it's a mass media campaign, and understand, I'm actually very optimistic about this, because I think that in some ways, I do believe that, well, first of all, we're going to win because we've already won. And so it's really, in some ways, the battle was already done by Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior. So in some ways, all of this is kind of just, let's bring as many people along, let's do the best we can and all that. So I have a cheerfulness to me when I'm able to fight this stuff. Do you realize we're up against very bitter, resentful, and arrogant people. Do you notice that? And they're bitter in some ways because a lot of them have not yet come to Christ. They don't believe in God. They're resentful for not very good reason, but they've been taught ingratitude, right? So here's the divide that's happened in America right now, is that we have one side of our country that is incredibly angry that they live in America. The other side is incredibly thankful that they live in America. You see, the Bible in the New Testament talks about this quite a lot, and you could cite the scriptures far better than I can, Pastor Jack, the importance of gratitude, the importance of saying thanks. And I think that we have an entire day that's uniquely American, Thanksgiving, around that idea of saying thanks. It's a uniquely Christian thing, actually, when you think about it. Because how could an atheist say thanks? Who are they thanking? Right? I mean, seriously, who are they saying thank you to? Themselves? I mean, that's like really, maybe, I mean, that's incredibly not narcissistic. Maybe they are. Explains a lot. But you're thankful that a creator was able to give you this gift. You're thankful for a family, thankful you're breathing, you're thankful for all these different things. I think that gratitude is the fruit that makes all of the things taste sweet. I think that if you don't have gratitude, especially for a country that you live in, then why wouldn't you rip that country apart, and then why wouldn't you destroy it? Well, gratitude comes from an understanding of the passage and the journey that your country has had. So you remove the history, you by definition then remove the gratitude. And it's very diabolical and incredibly pathological, because the people that are purveying it and communicating to our kids, they're actually themselves very, very resentful people. You will not find a thankful person teaching gratitude to another person. It's almost never. Ingratitude is passed from one ingrateful person to another, always, right? And so you have an ingrateful person passing upon their ingratitude. And this happens because one of the few ways that they can psychologically cope with the nihilism that sets in when you don't believe in an ultimate creator, you don't believe in the type of ecclesia that we're able to gather, the only way you can cope and find meaning is be able to get other people to be miserable alongside you. It's that old adage, we say it a lot, misery loves company, and my goodness, is that true? And so I ask myself the question, a couple things, young men in particular, because there's a crisis with young men in our country, we've got to get really serious about it, it's a very serious thing, and people say, you're not allowed to talk about it, so that means I talk about it a lot extra, because there's a real crisis here, And there's a crisis with young women too, but it's different. The male crisis actually, I think, is in some ways much, much more urgent. Because young men come to me and say, Charlie, what am I supposed to live for? So find something that you could take responsibility for. Don't just indulge yourself all the time. They say, well, what does that mean? Responsibility means that if you're not there, someone else fails. That's what responsibility is.
That's right.
You're not there, your kid doesn't get picked up from school. You're not there, your small group falls apart. You're not there, your job is less effective. That is responsibility. Go find some and put as much on your shoulders as you could possibly bear. And it's going to get awful and tough, and go do it. Because that's actually what's going to give you meaning, and we don't teach our kids this. Instead, we teach our men in particular, you're awful. Okay, I got that. No, you're really awful. Okay, thanks. Go become a woman. Like, what? No, I don't want to do that. And in fact, we tell them there's something so incredibly awful. We break them down so much that we wonder why youth suicide is going up so dramatically. We wonder why drug usage and social isolation, it's like, well, maybe you shouldn't have spent the first 15 years of that young man's life saying they're the worst thing on the planet. Instead you should have said, go pick yourself up, stop acting like a punk, don't swear, stop doing drugs, get up earlier and find some meaning in your life, and that means responsibility.
That's right.
And that's how you got to talk to young men, because it's different than young women. And it's talked about in Proverbs, right? If you don't work, you don't eat. And I think there's actually a deeper psychological truth to that, actually, which is, if you don't work, you don't find responsibility, you're not going to be able to keep going, right? What is the metaphorical truth behind eating? It's that I can keep doing what I want to do to the next day, right? And so for our crisis with young people that's happening, see, what colleges do and what they should do, but they don't, we'll kind of talk about it. What colleges should do, let's start there. Colleges should say, my goodness, what an awful, broken, chaotic world that we have. I'm going to try to make you stronger so that you can endure the suffering better, that you can straighten out your path, that you can have stronger shoulders, that you can bear the burden, and then you'll be more prepared for the forest, for the swamp, for the demons, for the people that will stab you in the back, because you're going to suffer, but I'm going to help you make sure that you can endure it a little bit better so your life will be a little less miserable. That's basically what we should teach them in college. Instead we teach them this. If anything scares you, tell me and I'm going to remove it. Seriously, this is what we do in college. If anything dares challenge you,
yes,
scream with your hands up and say, microaggression, trigger warning, safe space. I don't like the way that sounds. Remove it from the conversation. And we wonder why we have an entire generation, mostly, of kids that are afraid to leave their own shadow, are afraid to even to have their own meaning. It's because we have infantilized these children at the most important time of their life, when we're supposed to be able to say, you're not the most important thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Stop indulging yourself. You're actually a coward for looking at that stuff on your phone at 2 a.m. You're actually not doing something heroic by drinking more than the friend next to you. No one cares how many social media likes that you have. How about you go be loyal to a singular human being, get married, find a job, act with meaning, have a bunch of kids, and then go to church. That's going to make your life better, not limitlessly indulging in the next chemical substance that might be on the table. College does the exact opposite.
Charlie, you mentioned something earlier about suicide.
Yeah.
And
I've lost many friends to suicide. And go ahead.
Regarding the age in which we're in right now, there's various ways to commit suicide. And one of the ways to commit suicide almost always is the way of losing hope. Yeah. When hope is gone, you're done. There's a lot that can go on in your life that doesn't lead to suicide. But when you lose hope, and hope is very, very, I believe, inseparably connected to purpose.
When you have
hopelessness, you're done. And that means you're done by either the rope or a gun. You're done. When you lose hope, you're dead. And here's the thing. A lot of young people today are in the basement, in their pajamas at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're actually committing suicide. They're en route to losing hope. Yeah. If they stay on that path, it may take a longer time. Satan doesn't care, as long as he gets you there. Somebody could lose hope in a matter of moment because their dreams were dashed and the experiment blew up and it didn't work, or they lost all their money in the stock market in 5 seconds, and they lose hope and they bite a bullet. But the same terminus the enemy targets for any young man or young woman who sits in their house and rots without a purpose, Satan just licks his chops.
Well, yeah, and I've lost dear friends to suicide. A friend of mine from high school, Eddie, committed suicide. It's one of the hardest things that I had to process. And for those of you who have lost friends to suicide, it really does a torturous thing to the people around. It's not an easy thing. It's not. And a lot of prayer, a lot of reflection, and still I struggle with it. You say, my goodness, you know, what were the steps that were taken there? It's a very serious thing, and our politicians refuse to engage on this topic. They just absolutely do, and this is a cultural crisis, and it's happening at an increasingly alarming rates. And there's a couple things that I think that actually have contributed to this, and there's not one sole piece of this. But part of it is that we have taught young children and young people in particular self-esteem, not self-control. And it's a very important thing, and Dennis Prager talks about it a lot, and he's phenomenal, where if you actually teach people, as in the halls of Harvard, it's this beautiful quote, and they're going to remove it, I'm sure, because it makes far too much sense. It says, the law are the wise restraints that keep men free. And what that really is saying, that if you do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it, you're actually going to be a slave to whatever those things are. And when Christ said we are going to liberate you from sin, he literally means that when you are free from the addiction and free from the sinful pattern and behavior that you have. But much more materially, as we have this in our country about suicide and self-worth, I think that in a lot of different ways, we have not been so as blunt and as honest we should about the reality of the world that we live in. I think that we try to tell young people that we somehow can create a better, more comfortable world for you if we are just able to shut up a couple more voices and do all this, when we really should be talking about creating stronger, tougher people that can endure the incredible persecution and suffering that is inevitable in life, because life is absolutely a tragic exercise in suffering. I mean, the Bible tells us, any sort of life experience tells us, we know that. And so once you are able to communicate that clearly, and young people say, wow, that sounds awful, but here's what you can do about it. Here's how you can actually get through it. And that's where we get this wrong completely and totally, where the conversation when it comes around meaning, what is going to keep you going from one day to the other, where you're not in your pajamas at 2 o'clock on the next day is actually a doctrine of connectedness. And we don't talk about this, where that a lot of times people need to know that other people are relying on you. And that's the idea of responsibility, right?
That's right.
Is that, of course, you have a responsibility for yourself, but why be responsible for yourself? It's because another person is going to want to make sure they see you at 7 a.m. because you actually have something to offer this bitter and broken world, that you actually might have something deep within the bowels of your depraved existence that matters, that you might have something that you can contribute for the betterment of the kingdom. And when I talk about responsibility to young men and young people, they light up. They say, oh, my goodness, that's really something. I've never heard of that. I've just heard about how everything around me is wrong and is awful. And we talk about the responsibility of Christians, right? There's so much responsibility put on our shoulders every single day, and there's a
That's
greater
right.
microscope and persecution around that. But suicide is nothing to be trivialized. It's a very serious thing. And there's many contributing factors to it, a lot. And some of it, I think, stems from, in a lot of different ways, I think social media plays a huge role in it. I can go into a more practical sense of that. I think those little smartphones that we all have done incredible damage to social
That's
status
right.
of young people, and I think we have to have a real conversation around that
That's
in
right.
our country. But from a more serious sense that I have this, is that there's someone listening to this inevitably by the law of averages. And all I have to say is, if you're thinking any form of self-harm, all I have to say is, you know what? You're right. Life is really, really hard. It is awful. But there's something that you have to offer that actually might make somebody else's life a little less awful. And that's a reason to keep going. And if just one person needs to hear that today, then this visit was worth it.
So, Charlie, I want to change it up in a strange way to come into the conversation.
Sure.
So why is it that the physicians I know, physicians that attend this church, they tell me, Jack, the biggest thing to fear out there right now medically, outside of cancers and outside of other things, diabetes and all, the biggest thing to fear out there right now, and I'm sorry, I can't say the name of it, but there's two flus that are out there that's been out there for a long time. There's two flus running around that are very fatal, very dangerous, but COVID is way down on the list. But you wouldn't get that by the media.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that by the press. COVID is for real, we get it, but it's not the most lethal thing that's out there right now. What's going on?
Yeah, I won't be able to comment on that in particular, but I will say, look, I lost a dear friend yesterday to the virus, and it's really hard to talk about and still wrestling through that and reconciling it. The original mentor and person that believed in me at Turning Point USA, and he was 80 years old and internally optimistic person. Mm-hmm. So if your life has been touched by anything I've ever said or Turning Point USA, you can thank this man, Bill Montgomery, for that, because he was a 72-year-old eternal optimist who grabbed me when I was 18 years old, and I was lost. And this is a great lesson for anyone out there who's saying, well, what can I contribute to the world? Well, find a young person and do exactly what he did to me. And he said, Charlie, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with my life, and I didn't get into West Point. College just wasn't speaking to me. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. And out of nowhere, like, the Holy Spirit filled him and came to me at an event after I spoke at when I was 18 years old in high school. This man came up to me, Bill, and he said, Charlie, don't go to college. I said, what are you talking about? Don't go to college. What are you talking about? Who are you? And I'm in suburban America. I have good grades. You know, I'm Eagle Scout. Like, what? Don't go to college? Like, and he had this smile that could light up an entire room. And he said, don't go to college. He said, I think that there's something in store for you the likes of which you could never imagine. And this was a 72-year-old, right? And, So it was a very amazing journey, and I ended up not going to college and starting Turning Point in June of 2012. And he was the original mentor and traveled the country with me, and I wanted to give up 6 months into it. And he knew how to talk to me, I'll tell you that much. And it's a really important thing, right? Know how to talk to people when who you're talking to. He said, Charlie, you know what? If you give up, I'll be very disappointed in you. And that's exactly what I needed
that's
to hear, right?
That's exactly.
It's like, okay, that was it. Not getting angry and all that. And I kept going. And, you know, I was an 18-year-old. If I had a list of everyone that said I was not going to succeed, go back to college, do all these things, but this guy, In the most idealistic sense, he just said, press on, press on. And he was with me, and it was more than just a urging. He was the for everything from the Uber driver. You can't rent cars when you're 18, right? So when I was traveling, he helped rent cars. I couldn't check into a hotel, and he checked into hotels for me and handed me the keys. And he was there in the tough moments and the tense moments. Our operating budget was literally, you know, $8,000 for the entire year, and he believed in me. And like a prism, I kind of look at this as a prism theory, his single beam of light, this guy that was living a life where he was just looking for someone to connect to, found an 18-year-old that was looking for that. And we've impacted millions of people at Turning Point mm-hmm. USA. We're on 2,000 high school and college campuses. Yeah. And I apologize, Jack. I know it's a deviation from what you said, but it has to. I really need to say this.
No.
And it's a. If anyone's been touched by Turning Point, or anyone, if you've been touched by anyone that's ever come through the ranks of Turning Point or spoke, or the impact we've had for years, it can come back to that single piece of light, believing in a singular high schooler. And, you know, tragically, he passed away yesterday, and that's a real hard thing for me to wrestle with. And so, look, I just want to make sure I commit that to, you know, that I live out his legacy every single day and what we're doing. And he would have told me to speak tonight. I know that, and that's why I'm here.
So the impact of a strong male...
A strong male, a
biblically based masculinity,
yes,
is a very powerful life shaping.
And look, he was, yeah, and it's exactly right. And so now I look at how all of a sudden, you know, I'm speaking to 2,000 people tonight, and we're talking to tens of thousands on the live stream. I very easily could have been a lost cause. I mean that.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the inevitability of my journey. I don't.
That's right.
People say, oh, Charlie would have come back. I said, that's not true at all. I know people far more talented than mm-hmm. I that lost their path. And so just one final thought on that is, he happened to find me at the right time. I happen to be ready to listen. It's a great thing for a young person out there. I happen to be ready to listen to it and take a crazy, bold path and step. And God works in very mysterious ways, I can tell you. And the final point I'll say is this, is that... we look at our country and we look at how some of us are wondering, when are things going to rise up? It's that which is seen and unseen. There are things happening in our country that we don't even recognize
right.
and realize, the people that are being converted every single day, when people are dropping the shackles of leftism and liberalism that are coming around there. And, you know, you kind of look at these prisms of light that exist, right? And that should be a lesson to everyone in this room. Is there a young person? Is there a person in general that needs to hear something that you have to say that can spread goodness further and further, further in the world?
That's right.
And I'm a living extension of one person who did that. So anyway, that's what I
believe that. Yep, that's awesome, Charlie. I believe that's an awesome argument to the reality of the Bible and the existence of God. Our human capacity longs for opportunity like that. We long for when you're little, when you're so impressionable. You're looking, you don't even realize you're looking for a strong or good word to come to you. But you know you want it. You're not sure what you want until somebody says it. And then someone says, you know what, you can do this, or whatever it might be. That's why organized team sports. I'm a big fan of organized team sports. I'm not against you being a tennis pro. That's fantastic. Or a golfer. That's great. But there's something about team.
I agree.
And when that is exchanged, which is an argument for us being created in the image of God, we don't do well, and we're not supposed to do well with being torn down. But the moment somebody says, you know what, I think you can actually do that. It's that old saying that hope springs eternal.
Amen.
And you thank God for America, or America is thankful for you and having him speak into your life. And you are the result of one man's encouragement.
And it's the multiplier effect, and it just shows amazing. You spread truth to one person who could spread it to millions, who can spread it to millions, and maybe they'll spread it to millions. And all of a sudden, you have people that are organically communicating with each other that both have worldviews that were informed by the millions of ripples that no one even knew. And maybe those people end up implicating, you know, millions of more. And it can happen like that, and it will, and I know that, and I've seen it happen. And just to show you that, that's why I'm an eternal optimist with these things. Because I say this quite honestly, Jack. People say, well, the left, they control Hollywood, you bet. Big tech, absolutely. They control most of government, the deep state, the schools, they control the civil service, all that. Like, yeah, Charlie, how can we be optimistic? It's like, let them have all of that. Just give me the truth and let them have that. Because that's the one thing they do not have.
That's
they don't
right.
have.
They don't have it.
And they can have all of that. My experience is this: one sentence of truth can deflate a lifetime of lies. One sentence.
That's right.
And I get messages every single day on our podcast and what we are doing from, you know, with people, and they say, "Charlie, you said one thing that really resonated with me." I sometimes laugh, because sometimes it's not the most wise thing that I thought I could have possibly said. Like, you said this one sentence, and it put me on a path to the red pill. And, like, you know, the whole Morpheus analogy is working very well, right? And so, and sometimes it's something as simple as, if socialism was so good, why did the caravan go to America, not Venezuela? And they said, once you said that, it all kind of came together. Like, that's what did it for
you,
really?
Wait, did you guys all get that? He said that so fast. Did y'all get that?
Well, so if socialism was so great, why did the caravan come north for America, not south for Venezuela? Why does the movement of human beings always come towards societies that are rooted in individual initiative and liberty, not in tyranny and collectivized control? I mean, human beings will gravitate towards what is actually prosperous, good, and true. And so there's actually a tremendous amount of truth behind it. I'm not trying to trivialize it. So
no, Prager just recently said that during the 300 and some odd years of slave trading, that 304,000 slaves were captured by Muslim slave traders in North Africa and then put on the market and sold to the United States. 304,000 during those centuries. But in the last 15 years, there's been 2.5 million North Africans immigrate to the United States by choice. The United States is still the number one place. By the way, we receive more immigrant applications than any other nation on earth, still. And the United States is the only country that people break into. They want to come here. Remember what we're being told. We are so bad. We are so terrible. Yet...
yeah, it's a perplexing thing. We're the only country in the history of the world where even those who say they hate it refuse to leave.
They even promised us that they would leave.
That's how you know you live in actually an awesome country is, I hate this place.
I hate this place. Let's go to Disneyland.
Colin Kaepernick, you're now worth $50 million. That's how you actually know you live in an awesome country where you can get so rich at hating that country. It's incredible.
In
it was a cottage industry. Only in America can you too become worth $50 million saying that you live in an awful place. And there's a tremendous amount of truth with that. And it's almost become fashionable to hate everything around you, right? And it's actually, it takes more wisdom, more restraint, more maturity to actually say, no, there's actually been generations of sacrifice to create all the institutions around us. But it's actually the actions of a petulant child that would act that way, because there's no gratitude for what preceded them.
Yep. Time is flying.
We can do questions, or do we, whatever you, I mean.
We'll just keep going, but remember, 8:30, people, if you've got kids, 8:30.
No, I'm.
You can bring your kids back in the sanctuary.
I'm not leaving the stage at 8:30. I want to keep going.
Bring your, you can get your little ones.
Thank you. You
can bring your little ones in from the children's ministry. But listen, so let's talk about this upcoming election.
Sure.
Let's talk about truth. Let's talk about what's at stake. Let's talk about the fact, let's be honest, and I know you and I know this really well, is the fact that Donald Trump being in the presidency, no matter how or what you think about him, remember, the night that the election started, he was down by 20 points. He wasn't supposed to win.
Yeah.
He not only became the president, but he became the president in spite of the Republican Party. And in CNN and a lot of people on Fox and the Democrat Party and like a whole... Listen, here's the deal. Here's the thing. What's with Christians who can't vote? Why? What are they doing?
Well, yeah, let's dive into that. But first, you know, the guy who came down the golden escalator defeated 16 other Republicans, called out how both parties have betrayed the American middle class, beat the media, beat the Clintons, beat the Bushes, beat voter fraud, deep state, and big tech, gets spied on, becomes president, they launch a fake Russia Mueller probe, we end up moving the embassy, deleting the Iran deal, killing Qassem Soleimani, Baghdadi, eliminating ISIS, most pro-life president in American history.
Wait, Gorsuch, say it again. Most pro-life president
in American history. You got Gorsuch, you got Kavanaugh, you got over 200 circuit court judges, more regulations cut than any other president since Abraham Lincoln, believe it or not. We had the best economy in American history. They throw a virus at us. However you believe it came here, we can dive into that, but whatever.
You're going to hear more soon.
And we lock down our country. Then we decide that we're an awful country. We want to burn it down to the ground. Race riots. and they impeached him back in January, and we thought we were going to go to war with Iran. Did you think it was going to be easy when a disruptor became president? Did you think that all of a sudden that this was going to be a seamless entry into all of a sudden putting the power back to the people away from the kingdom of Washington, D.C.? No, this actually makes a lot of sense.
Yes,
this makes sense that the man that is there, he is a vessel for each and every one of you that believes that the ruling class in our country has not been serving your best interest. One other thought on that, Jack. He is, you know, people say, well, I don't like his tone, I don't like his tweets, I don't like all that. Well, that's fine. I think that's a separate topic in some ways. Look, he's the bodyguard to civil society. He's guarding the door. It's that simple. When you hire a bodyguard to defend your family when riots are outside, do you go and tap him on the shoulder when the bullets are flying and they're coming close? Hey, man, can I look at your tweets? Like, and he's like, you understand the mob's like right there, right? And I'll take care of it. Just make sure I stay here and I don't leave the door, because civil society's right there. Like, I gotta stay right here in front of this door, and I'm gonna make sure I hold them back. You're like, can you fix your tone a little bit? Like, did I not just mention the mob is literally right there that wants to burn everything down? So I kind of think it's a clumsy argument, to be honest with you. Because we're not electing a human being. Get that out of your mind. The United States presidency is electing a worldview. It's electing an entire infrastructure of a philosophy of ideals, ideas, and how you want the government and the country to go. Donald Trump is merely a representation of civil society. Donald Trump is merely a placeholder for what is moral and what is good. And my goodness, I'll tell you what. I kind of like the fact that he punches back a little bit. I like the fact that he fights. You know, I think that what is not defended ends up decaying. That what is not put forward with truth ends up getting robbed by what is evil and dark. And people say, well, Charlie, I just think that he's had a very checkered and troubled past. I said, well, if I could be as good as you one day, please give me the instruction manual for that.
That's the big deal. People will say always, well, you know, he's got a checkered past. Every single one of you have got a checkered past.
Amen.
We all do. Here's the thing. He's not the guy that he used to be. You know, we're America. We're supposed to be so forgiving and so kind and so prone to give people a second chance. But we turn around and we go after this guy. And here's what I'd like to put out before you. Look how his kids speak and treat and their relationship with each other. Did you know, where were we? We were somewhere not too long ago where the Trump kids, did you know the Trump kids get a call from him every day? No matter where he is in the world, he calls his kids every day. Look how they speak about their dad. And here's the cool thing. That dude's got way more stuff vested in this nation than we do. The guy owns an empire, and he's responsible for tens of thousands of employees. But his biggest treasure is his grandkids. Yeah. He's got a lot going on. If I had his billions, I would not be president. Right?
Your church would be a little bigger.
Think about it. You would. Why would you be 74 years old and take on that job? And I'll be quiet with this. If you have any doubt about him getting the job done or who or what he stands for, look at who his enemies are.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And so there's a lot of Christians that say, well, I'm not going to, and there's certain publications that have done this, and you know them better mm-hmm. than I do, Christian publications, and they say, well, I'm not going to tolerate Donald Trump and all of his shenanigans and all this sort of stuff. I say, man, you must be really okay with 1 million abortions a year to have that kind of snobbish, elitist attitude. And I'm not willing to go in front of my creator with that kind of cockiness, my friend.
Right on.
I am not willing to face judgment and say, you know, the 1 million abortion a year thing, I decided to stay silent on that because I didn't like a guy's tone. I'm not prepared to make that argument. I'm not. And nor am I saying you should make an excuse. That's not what I'm saying. Instead, what I'm saying is, my goodness, you have a vessel for the first time. You had a president speak at the March for Life in our country. George W. Bush didn't speak
at
the March for Life.
That's right.
And so then, you know, let's talk about this. And people say, well, Charlie, I love George W. Bush. That's fine. He's a very nice person. He's a Christian and all of that. But you have John Roberts thanks to George W. Bush. John Roberts just ruled that churches are not essential, that salvation is not essential. And the Calvary Chapel in Las Vegas closed. And now you're seeing persecution of Christians across the country, George W. Bush. But guess what? The two justices that Donald Trump put on the court, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, said clearly and emphatically, church is essential and churches should remain open. But hold on a second, Christian Post. Hold on a second, Ivory Tower Christians and the Southern Baptist Convention. You're better human beings than I am, explain to me very clearly, the Christian George W. Bush put John Roberts on the court, and the three times married, twice divorced, once cover of the Playboy magazine person that you think is vulgar and awful, he's defending Christianity more than the person that you say is more fit to be president. So don't give me that nonsense for any second whatsoever. Because I have so clearly right now, and my goodness, it is this ivory tower, I'm better than you are, snobbish style of Christianity.
That's right.
That I have, my patience is zero, done nothing with it, okay? And it is.
That's right.
It is, and I see some of the, I watch some of their speeches and I read some of their writings and they say, oh, they're so unacceptable in this and decline of a nation and all of that. And I say, my goodness, I cannot get to a place where I am perfectly acceptable and okay with the United States Supreme Court saying that churches are not essential. I'm going to fight for justices that fight for that. I'm going to fight for the rule of law. I'm going to fight for the unborn. I'm going to fight for someone who fights for those certain things. And the final point I'll say is this. You know, some Christians, they have tough time squaring it. They say, well, I don't know if I'm going to vote. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. Politics, it's beneath me and all this. And I think it's a very simple decision-making matrix. I ask the question, I say, well, does God care how you act? And any reasonable Christian say, yeah, of course, yeah. Well, is voting acting? Well, yeah. So does God care how you vote? Yes, of course he does. If you're voting for people that are okay and want to increase the amount of unborn children that are terminated in the womb every single year, how is that not an extension of your moral action? How is that not an extension of your biblical worldview? How is that not an extension of the text that you're reading that says all people are made in the image of God? Of course he cares about how you vote. Of course.
Listen, this is very interesting because I can speak to this a little bit, that there are more Bible studies and prayer meetings in this administration and cabinet than any other recorded time in American history. And that's an absolute fact. And what's amazing about what's going on is this president, one of the first things, many of you don't know this, but before President Trump was even sworn into office, he turned to a man who was tapped with writing the 2016 Republican Party platform. And you know that guy. And Donald Trump turned to Tony Perkins and said, I'm going to do this the first chance I get, and that is I want to get Christians that are being religiously persecuted in other parts of the world, I want to get them home. And did you know, wait, you don't, listen, this is just one that made it on the news. Most of it is deliberately, you're not hearing about it because it's not good to publicize this. But President Trump, before he was sworn into office, already had the gears and the equipment, so to speak, rolling to get Pastor Brunson out of Iran. Was it Iran? And this president is incredibly committed to religious freedoms and religious rights. And we are told, I have the opportunity to be on what's called Evangelicals for Trump, the EFT team. It's about 50 pastors. And then I also happen to be on the FIT team, which is the Faith Initiative team, which is just a handful of guys. But having said that, I remember being in Miami with the president, and he walked into a room of just a handful of people, and he said, and they were all pastors, and he said, give them that book. If you give them the book, your community will do fine. Now, that's quite a statement to make. He didn't have to make it, but I'm moved by that. It's something that you didn't hear from Bush, or you didn't hear from Obama, or you just didn't hear that kind of stuff. I don't know where President Trump's faith is at. He believes in God. I don't know where he's at regarding his salvation. I do not know that. However, he's just like either Jehu in the Bible or Cyrus. God, you cannot deny that God is using him. You cannot deny that. The first president to ever acknowledge Israel and its capital being in Jerusalem. You have a new book coming out.
Oh, geez, it's not public yet.
Oh,
I mean,
sorry.
I'm actually working on it. I mean, yes, I'm happy to talk about it. We're still working on the finalization, but you guys are like family, so I'll share it with you. So, it's a book where I'm challenging the idea that every kid needs to go to college. And I'm thinking of the right way to write it and the right way to present it, but I think that this cultural expectation that we have set on young people, that they have to go to four-year university, I think it is unhealthy. I think it's financially troubling. It's culturally troubling. And I think that it's time that someone speaks out against it. I'm either in the worst or the best position to speak out against it because I didn't go to college. So I think in some ways I'm in a good position to make that argument. Make no mistake, I am not anti the university in the ideal sense. I think the university can and should be a place where ideas can be shared in a Socratic method, where we can find universal truth and that we can be able to hear the other side. That doesn't happen at a university. I think that you should have a place that exists that trains young people to be able to endure the world they're about to enter. That is not the university. I think we should have a place where it is more about education than accreditation. That is not the university. We have a culture right now where we have people that are borrowing money they do not have to study things that don't matter, to find jobs that do not exist. I'm a massive proponent of an exit exam for anyone that goes to college. Show me what you have learned by the time you graduate in order to get your diploma. I mean, that would kind of be nice, right? You should be able to pass a very basic U.S. civics course. You should be able to tell me the difference between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Yep. You should be able to, just basic things, right? And that doesn't happen. And let's just look at the fruit of which has been delivered from the university. The New York Federal Reserve said that 40% of recent college graduates are now employed in jobs, if they're employed at all, of jobs that do not require a college degree. Mind you, 41% of kids that go to college will not graduate. So we are dealing with an overpopulation problem of our colleges. And I'm going to be very honest with you. The amount that you parents are paying in tuition is outrageous, and it's a scam. And it really is.
That's right.
And you are paying tens of thousands of dollars for something that I think, quite honestly, is one of the most disingenuous, deceiving cultural expectations we have.
It's absolutely true. So little of what they pay goes to the actual education of their child. They're paying austerity programs. They're paying retirement programs.
Correct.
They're paying for so many things.
Yeah, and so you have to ask yourself the question, why do I want to go to college? So I always make the argument, start from the default position, I'm not going to go to college, and then prove to myself why I should go to college.
That's very good.
And so just start from the default, not. We don't. Right now we start from the default I am. So we ask high school seniors, hey, where are you going to school? Not why are you going to school. When I ask high school seniors, hey, why are you going to college? I don't get the best answers, to be honest. Oh, they have a good sports team. My parents are making me. Parents are making you bad reason, to be perfectly honest. And I'm going to speak this with love and compassion. Parents, you got to have better reasons to send your kids to college.
I agree.
Just thinking that it's
I agree.
It's a
Charlie, I agree. Listen, and how about this? And you probably write about this in your book that's coming out. Is
that hasn't so, been written?
So yet. I've had parents actually say
you
to me.
You guys are really ahead of the curve.
I've had parents say to me in the foyer or in the courtyard, Pastor Jack, any good colleges? What do you think in the universities? And I say what Charlie just said. Are you sure? Why don't you have them take a year off first before they even go? And then let me ask you this. Are you going to pay for it? Oh, I've been saving up all my life for my kid to go to college. Can you imagine if you take that money and you go into business
Amen.
In a passion for your child? Like, let's say your kid's mechanically inclined. Or let's say your kid is whatever. You know your kid. What if you went into business with him? Or what if you helped him start something? He'll learn more, even if that business were to fail. He would learn more than he would be learning in a college.
No doubt. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, I completely agree. What is the college system producing? Generally, they're producing ungrateful, arrogant, resentful, bitter people. And so maybe there's something wrong with the institution. Of course there is. We're conservatives like myself have to show up with an army that could stage a coup in Guatemala. I mean, I show up with a standing army, the likes of which helicopters are flying over. I kid you not, I've spoken at universities in this state, UCLA, UC Berkeley, Stanford. I've spoken all across the state. We had one in Long Beach where they had to shut down the entire sector because I'm such a dangerous, hateful person because I say Jesus Christ is our Lord and Savior, God is real, and there's only two genders. Like, what a crazy thing to say, right? So, not exactly the world's most controversial thing you could possibly. And by the way, I never attack people personally. I say it compassionately and lovingly, and I try my best to do that, I should say. I don't always succeed. But for some reason, I'm such a threat to the university, where in reality, the university is a threat to truth. And so, yeah, that's one of the questions I have about. But I get it. I come from a culture in suburban America where there is a baked-in expectation that you have to go to college. It's a matter of where you're going to college. It is so built in to the entire culture of America. And basically what I want to do is just not tell you what to do, but tell you that it's okay if you don't go. To tell you that's a different argument than saying, do not go. Don't do that. Like, that's okay. I don't know your circumstances. And maybe the college is right if you want to become an engineer or something very specific. But a majority of people that go to college say, well, I want to find myself in college. Well, that's a great way to lose yourself. My gosh. you're going to learn to hate America and you won't find much meaning, that's for sure. And, you know, I kind of look at a track, right? So I want to do this, and I'm trying to find the right way, and I'm trying to find the right person to help support it. I want to do a test where I take 10 kids that could have gone to a good college, take the equivalent of what they would have spent in a very simple money market account and mutual interest, you know, mutual funds, and have them go into minimum wage work and work their way up in something they have a passion for, something they have a talent for, track them over a decade versus the 10 people that go to these schools and who's going to be doing better over the next 10 years. And I just know that the people that would have entered the world immediately, and there's a couple reasons for this. I'm a huge believer in a gap year. I'm a massive believer that a huge portion of our society actually, and I'm not one of these people, mind you, but they actually want to work with their hands 8 hours a day. And we, as a society, we have demeaned and diminished,
That's
ostracized
right.
and penalized labor work with your hands, people that
so
want
wrong.
To be involved in the crafts all day long. And in fact, we've actually tried to act as if these people are less than. They're not as intelligent, they're not as wise, they're non-college educated. They don't know what they're talking about. Let me be very precise and very clear. I have met, every plumber I have met has far more wisdom than the Harvard faculty. Okay, let
me
be very clear.
Not only wisdom, oh my goodness. Charlie, I was just going to say, there's plumbers I know, there's plumbers I've met.
I love plumbers.
First of all,
imagine a world without plumbers. It's an awful thing to think about.
I talked to a guy who didn't want to, thought about going to college, wound up, his dad had taught him plumbing. He's a young guy. Point is, he makes over 200,000 bucks a year being a plumber. And I don't know what a college grad on the average makes, but
their net worth is in the negative before we even start the game, right?
That's
so it'd be one thing if you started at a carbon neutral, right? Or just a neutral point. Okay, but you're already negative before you go to the game, in the game. And quite honestly, you're around a culture that is not about aspiration or flourishing. You're around people that basically are telling you everything is awful, and you're not exchanging ideas on how to create new businesses. You're exchanging ideas on how to take down the Christopher Columbus statue, right? So it's kind of a completely different kind of scope of work, right? Where we have this idealistic sense. I talk to these parents. I love them to death. I love these people. Some of these people are wonderful people. They're like, yeah, my kid's going to go to college and he's going to learn, you know, how to exchange business practices. I'm like, my goodness, I don't know. First of all, there's only a few colleges where that would happen. Liberty University. I put my full name behind Jerry Falwell Jr. and Liberty. Great place. And we should say the good ones that are out there, the vast minority. But I said, you're probably going to find your kid is going to come up with some sort of scheme on how to make sure they take down the statues of Jesus Christ in the chapel at Georgetown, not actually exchange entrepreneurial business practices. But here's my big belief. I'm a huge believer in gap years, a massive believer, especially for young men, because I think that out of high school, we push kids way too quickly into this college atmosphere where it's immediately you're in debt, the clock is ticking, you're really not getting a value add to the education a lot of times. Gap year can teach you a lot. It really can. And quite honestly, I go to some, you know, I speak all across the country. I speak over 300 times a year, mildly interrupted because of the virus, but here we are back again, right? And so I speak in Highland Park, Texas. I speak at Orange County and Santa Ana. I could tell you that there is a gap in some of the upper income parts of our country where if you were to say to it's a very hard thing for certain parents to have this conversation and say, would you be okay if your kid became a plumber? And I could tell you this, a lot of people that live in West Hollywood or in Beverly Hills would say no. And I'd say, so you'd rather have your kid become a leftist than a plumber. Let me just make sure I'm clear. And you're like, oh, that's not true. Of course not. Like, okay, well, first of all, what's wrong with being a plumber? I mean, I like people like plumber, carpenter, or HVAC, or just someone that works with dignity. I mean, point is this, that we have, and we do this in public polling. You probably have noticed this recently where they say, well, Donald Trump, his biggest base is non-college educated white people. And college educated people hate him. And I, after the third time I heard this, I said, I know exactly what they're doing here. They're saying the dumb people love Trump and the smart people hate him. That's what they're doing. They're social conditioning us to believe that you don't want your kid to be in the non-college educated category because those are the hillbilly deplorables that are the people that are wrong in society. Send your kid to college and you too can be enlightened, like, oh my gosh, stop, whatever that is, stop doing that. And when in reality, it's, I know there's some people from PragerU and at Turning Point USA, we talk about it. I highly encourage you, say, Charlie, I don't know what to do. My kid doesn't know what to do. I said, perfectly fine, by the way. Yeah. Here's a recommendation. Gap year, have them go get a minimum wage job in something they have a talent or a passion for.
That's right.
Somebody in this church owns a business in something they have that talent or passion for. I tell the young person, strip down all your expectations of glam, the kind of side hustle. Like, why you can have a side hustle? You can't even do it. You can't even do your job. You want a side hustle. Like, what are you talking about a side hustle? I mean, Gary Vee, God bless him, swears way too much for me, by the way. It's like unbelievable. It's expletive after expletive. He's like, yeah, you got to have a side hustle. Like, you can't even make your bed and you want a side hustle. Like, what are you doing? Like, yeah, I mean, I'm going to make $10,000 a month being a social media influencer. Like, no, you're not. Go work at Wendy's, okay? Like, please. And then like, act properly and straighten yourself out. And by the way, stop smoking weed and don't drink and stop staying out till 2 a.m., and maybe unplug the video games at midnight or not do them at all. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with it. Just stop doing it and act properly. And all of a sudden, you're going to be ahead of everyone in 6 months. It's really not that complicated. And you're going to find meaning and responsibility in that. And then we act as if it's this really hard thing. But here's what I say to parents. Have them watch every single PragerU video and Fireside Chat by Dennis Prager.
That's right.
Three
awesome.
Times.
Yes,
three
so
times.
True.
Have them listen to my podcast at least 3 or 4 times a week. Have them read the book of Proverbs and the book of John so that they know it pretty well.
That's right.
Very important, right? Have them understand the teachings of the Bible. Have them read Maps of Meaning by Jordan Peterson and 12 Rules for Life. That kid will be destined for success more than a Yale-educated doctor in philosophy, okay?
That's totally true. That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely true.
And so, you know, a lot of parents come to me and they say, by the way, it's not just college. I want to broaden this conversation, if that's okay. And by the way, you can take me off stage anytime, Jack. I'll stay until you turn the lights off or we get arrested or both or whatever ends up happening. Right? So, at this point, who knows? Who cares? We're all going to heaven. So, Understand the indoctrination happens a lot earlier, and I think that we as decent, reasonable people, we don't address root causes like the left does. And this is why I'm a huge proponent that we need to double the homeschooling population in the next 3 years in our country. 3 years.
I think COVID is helping that happen.
I think we might triple it, right? So, and if you're a parent out there and you're uneasy about hearing that, I hear you. I understand.
Yes.
Like, I can't be a teacher. I say, first of all, just pray on it. There's more wisdom in that book to communicate to your child. If nothing more, if you teach them the Bible and how to read and write, you have done a beautiful service to them. Who cares if they can't recite the incantations of the 1619 Project,
okay? In this day and age, you're protecting their innocence and maybe their life.
Precisely. So, massive fan of homeschooling. Like, incredible. I think that homeschooling could save the Republic. And you heard it here first. That you're going to cut this video up in 5 or 10 years from now, and what I'm saying right now will be true. The Democrats are going to try to outlaw homeschooling in this country in the next decade. It is coming quickly. They're going to.
Look, unless Newsom gets out and his cohorts, they are diametrically opposed to you having the freedom to not only homeschool your kids, but charter schools and private
Amen.
Schools.
Yes.
They're already going after them here in California. Turning Point could have been based in California, but it's based in Arizona. Isn't it sad that Elon Musk now, who said, I don't want to leave California, I love California, now he announces, I'm sorry, but Tesla's leaving. SpaceX is leaving, Tesla's leaving, because we can't take it anymore here. This is tragic. You say, this is so terrible. Is it terrible enough for you to register to vote and vote these guys out of office? Because that's what's got to happen.
Yeah, and you can see, you know, it's really sad because in the 70s and 80s, California was the best of America. No one cared where you were from. They asked what you did, and it was a place of opportunity and reasonable tax policy and place of faith, and Calvary Chapels exploded in the 70s and 80s. And California, obviously, we all know the political decline that the state has gone. And it used to be reflected in California was in more songs and more movies and more TV shows as the ideal of America. And look no further than Full House. I mean, it's kind of a wacky show. But in some ways, it was actually a show that, you look, it couldn't really be aired today because it was about keeping the family together. And it always ended in some form of a moral good. And it was silly. And it was in San Francisco. And I think to myself, like, what would Full House look like? I mean, I know they're redoing it on Netflix. That's a bunch of nonsense. But like, what would Full House today, well, I could tell you what it looks like. It'd be Black Mirror. It'd be like everyone be spying on each other and social media controlling ourselves. Or maybe it would look like Portlandia, which actually might be more like an actual depiction of what's happening. And I think all of us recognize and realize that to a very, very, very real extent because, you know, California, in a lot of different ways, I think was a precursor of good things to come for America, and now we can't allow it to be a canary in the coal mine or a harbinger for things to come for the rest of the country. They're going to try to duplicate this model all across America. And the more that you can rise up in California and the more that you can communicate and really show and turn things, Mike Garcia winning in California, large
That's
part
key.
Thanks to a lot of you, that challenges the status quo. It really does. It challenges their power grab. They think of you guys as a nuisance, as an annoyance. They think of you guys as they want to run you over and just have a one-party state. But the more you're able to have little micro victories and build it up,
That's
my
right.
goodness, that is how truth is going to win.
You're absolutely right. Right on. Keep talking or...
No, I'll keep going. I got a couple more thoughts I want to share, though.
Share those thoughts.
Yeah.
Well, how about if we end at 9 o'clock? Because we've got friends
That's
right
fine.
Now streaming this
yeah,
in a particular...
I literally talk for 6 hours a day, so you can line me up and I can keep going. So, that's what I do. That was never a problem in my childhood, was communicating. That was not... got me in a lot of trouble. I finally found a job running Turning Point and talking all day long that I could do what I love. And I think that...
Isn't that great?
Oh, it's great. No, it's terrific. my God bless my podcast team, and please subscribe. They're like, Charlie, two podcasts a day is killing us. I'm like, you're lucky we're not doing three, because I want to do three. No, I'm kidding. So I love it. It's great. It's a blessing to be able to communicate. A couple other thoughts here, and we'll end at 9. Number one, people say, Charlie, what can I do? How many of you guys think that? Charlie, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? What can I do? I'll get this question, right? I feel helpless. I feel helpless. And so I've been studying the Soviet Union a lot, and it's, boy, man, you want to see how dark human beings can get. Just study the Soviet Union. We have done a moral disservice to our young people not explaining to them the horrors of the Soviet Union. We've done a pretty good job of explaining 1930s Germany and 1940s Germany, but we've done a very poor job of explaining Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky and the death of Tukhachevsky and how they took power through the Bolshevik Revolution and the Kulak slaughter and eventually Joseph Stalin. And as I've studied this, and I'm reading a phenomenal book by a Christian pastor who was locked up, I get his name wrong every time, Joseph Bondarenko. It's phenomenal, and he's incredible, and I'm working my way through the book, and I encourage all young people out there, please don't be afraid to read actual books. It's actually a really important thing. I know that it gets dismissed, and please, here's a challenge, here's a moonshot. Limit your screen time on your iPhone in half. You'll be a happier person, I can guarantee you that. So I'm reading about the Soviet Union, and what I've come to realize as Joseph Stalin took power, he had socialism in the cities and capitalism in the countryside, where the countryside and the peasants were living rather industrious lives of private property, and people were flourishing, and they were, oh, hey, hi there, and the Bondarenko family's here, like, oh my gosh, there you go. And they were living in incredible, they were actually doing okay, and Joseph Stalin was the ultimate embodiment of evil. And the history of Stalin is very interesting. He was a seminary student. He was learning the word of God. And then he ends up becoming a true rebel against God in the most pure sense. I mean, he actually never admitted that he didn't believe in God. He considered his existence as a struggle against God. I mean, it's in a very bizarre way is even more evil in some ways. And that's a different conversation for a different time. But Stalin thought of himself as a god, as a deity. And if you want to talk about someone who actually assumed the most totalitarian control, it'd be Joseph Stalin. He had control over everything, the Politburo, but he wasn't happy enough with the countryside not being socialist. So even though the countryside was basically functioning and working through private property and the price system, it was really the bread capital of most of Europe, was the countryside of Russia and Ukraine and Eastern Europe. He was an ideologue. And here's a very important point. People say, oh, Stalin didn't implement socialism. He really read Marx. He really wanted socialism everywhere because he knew it got him pure control. So he instituted what was called the persecution of the kulaks, right? So he went after any farmer that owned too much land. And it was so arbitrary, but it was really interesting when you read it. Stalin was he was a delegator. And this is so stunning, and it's a lesson for all of you here, because what can I do? He empowered many Stalins all across Russia. Like, Stalin wasn't alone. Like, it wasn't just him. He empowered 3,000 people to be the mini Stalins of their town. They empowered Stalins underneath them to be Stalins in the classroom, and the Stalins in the church, and the Stalins in the countryside. And you say, well, Charlie, what does that have to do with me? How many of you have allowed tyranny to come across your radar screen in the last couple weeks and you've said, should I do something or not?
That's right.
How many of you have seen an autocrat use strength against the weak in the last 3 weeks and you've asked, should I do something? Because that's exactly what happened in the Soviet Union, is there were micro-tyrannies, right? Is that there were many Joseph Stalins that popped up, and it was the teacher that went to the 8-year-old and said, you're evil because you're white, and the parent did nothing.
Yeah.
It's the local school district that says, we are going to teach the 1619 Project, and the parents said, well, I guess that's just the way it is. Or it's the store clerk that says something so outrageous because you won't round up your transactional purchase at the local grocery store to go fund BLM Inc., and they say you're the worst person in the world. Or it's the local fast food restaurant that makes all their employees take a knee, not to Jesus Christ, but to BLM for something they never did, blaming people on their immutable characteristics, which itself is evil, to blame something on something they did not do because of the melanin in their skin. And it is evil, and it should be spoken out against every single day.
That's right.
And
absolutely.
So what do you do about that? People say, well, Charlie, I know that tyrant. I want to think to yourself, who's the tyrant in your life? Because they're there. There's somebody in your life that's acting like a tyrant. You say, what's the definition of a tyrant? Using strength to exploit the weak. That is a tyrant. Unfairly. Get your words right. Doesn't matter if you make a fool out of yourself. Don't do it loudly or clumsily. But say something. God gave us language for a reason. Right? God gave us that ability to communicate. And you go up to him. It might be a letter. It might be an email. And you go to that tyrant. It might be a teacher. It might be whatever it is. and you say, what you're doing is wrong and I'm not going to stand for it. I want you to know why it's wrong and do it lovingly, but communicate them clearly in the right in the eyes and you tell them that. And you might say, that's not going to make a difference. And that's a really interesting thing because people say, well, Charlie, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I love this question, and I was inspired by the way Dennis Prager answered it the other day, because I know why people are asking a lot of the time. What they're really asking is like, hey, Charlie, can I give up now? They say, hey, if you say pessimistic, that means we can stop, right? And I always answer it honestly. I'm like, I'm optimistic about some things. I'm worried about other things, right? I mean, of course. I mean, we see what's happening. But it's completely irrelevant as to whether or not you're going to fight for truth.
That's right.
It's immaterial. What are you trying to say? My odds of winning are less, so I'm going to stop talking? So I don't think I'm going to do anything up against that tyrant teacher who's exploiting an 8-year-old because he happens to be white. I don't think I'm going to make a difference. That's not an excuse not to say something. So what? Right here, right now, you have 2,000 people in the room. There are thousands of micro-tyrants that want nothing more to use their positions of power to exploit the weak. All it takes is for good people to do something. So that's number one. And we have to do that as a country. We have to. Where you do not allow that to happen across your radar screen. On a micro level. Right there. On a material micro level. Last thing, Jack. I know we're out of time. The last thing is this. I hate this, but it's the way it is. The left has politicized everything. Food. Fat, everything, right? Sports. I can't watch baseball. I don't watch baseball anymore, and you should totally boycott baseball.
True.
I'm done.
It's
gone.
True.
Thank you. Goodbye. They are done. Cut them off.
Yep. So sad.
Let me close the thought super quick. We are done with baseball and all that. They've taken politics into everything. We say you do not bring politics, religion at the dinner table and all this. Guess what? We now have to be activists in everything we do. Where we shop, what we buy, where we go to church, how we communicate, where we send our kids to school. Now we have to be 24/7, 365 activists. That's right. Everything that you do has to reflect your value system. There is now nothing they have not touched. There's now nothing we are not going to touch. Every single decision you make must reflect your worldview.